Hello, and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. In moments, Trudy Lieberman will list some of the many failings of the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare. And at the bottom of the hour, historian Leah Gordon will discuss the history of scholarship on race in the U.S. and its transformation from the structural political to the individual psychological. First, Trudy Lieberman. She's a contributing editor to the Columbia Journalism Review, where she's been covering the coverage of health care reform, a beat she's prowled for many years. She's got an excellent story on Obamacare, or the Affordable Care Act, if you prefer, and the July issue of Harper's Magazine. In it, she examines the severe problems with the thing, not just falling short of universal coverage, but accelerating the shift towards individuals paying for more of their care. Unfortunately, the article's not on the web, but Harper's subscriptions are cheap. Trudy Lieberman. Trudy, I really don't want to take anything away from your work, because it's really remarkable, but why isn't anybody else doing anything like this? I mean, there's just a dearth of information about the Affordable Care Act, except from the crazies on the right.
Well, I think what's happened here is that journalists who might have been interested in writing about this or putting all of the facts together and connecting the dots haven't done it, because it was very interesting to see this right from the very beginning, that there was a whole bunch of people who were basically cheerleaders for getting something passed. Reporters who somehow took the sides of those who were trying to pass a law, if a style of law that we got. And I think that those groups did a lot to educate the reporters to their way of thinking, that this is the only way to go because we can't get anything better, and so this is the way it has to be. And there were all kinds of studies that were done and reports and so forth that got into the hands of journalists, and that's what really formed the basis for a lot of this reporting. And even during the run-up to the law in 2009 and early 2010, we didn't see very much critical reporting on this at all. And I know at CJR I was always urging reporters to write about this affordability issue because it was looming, and many of us knew that these deductibles and coinsurance amounts and so forth were going to be really high, and that ordinary families, middle-class families, were not going to be able to afford them. But that just didn't happen.
Towards the end of the piece, you asked the question, which I'm going to ask at the beginning of the interview, is it better than nothing?
I guess I would say probably yes, because certainly people have some coverage now, and certainly the millions of people who were newly eligible for Medicaid under the expansion have benefited greatly from it, because the Medicaid benefits in almost all the states is really pretty darn good. The people on the other side who were not in Medicaid expansion states have not benefited at all, and it's a great inequity in the law. It's a very heartbreaking inequity, as I pointed out in my story. So you have to say that that's been beneficial to people, and you could argue that people who were not insured under the Medicaid expansion but who bought Obamacare policies at least have had some coverage, even though many of them have had trouble actually getting coverage for what they need because they've had to pay these very high amounts out of pocket. And I think, to be fair, many people who have policies probably haven't used them yet. You know, you only really worry about a policy not being very good when you're sick and need it, and I think that hasn't happened across the board yet. So we really don't know the satisfaction rate as time goes on and people start seeing these policies in action. So that said, I think we have to say it's probably better than nothing, but there are so many problems with it and so many inequities and problems looming down the road that I think that we have hardly cured the problems of American health care.
Let's talk a bit about the intellectual pedigree of this law. There's, of course, Stuart Butler, going back to the Heritage Foundation in the 90s, and this Rooney fellow with his health savings accounts, who's also, his fingerprints are visible in the Affordable Care Act. It does have a fairly conservative pedigree, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. All of the elements of the Affordable Care Act, the tax subsidies for people who couldn't afford to buy insurance, the notion of the individual mandate making people buy insurance under the threat of a penalty, the state insurance exchanges, the shopping centers that have been set up in all the states to facilitate people buying insurance, were all elements that were mentioned in the academic literature in the early 90s. They were mostly conservative elements, but there were very many mainstream economists and advocates who were beginning to embrace these. I remember the notion of having an individual mandate in the early 90s was just crazy. I couldn't believe that anybody would be thinking about such a thing, because all that did was shift the cost of insurance to people least able to pay for it, and that's individual families. But we couldn't get an employer mandate because the employers didn't want to have to pay for it, and we couldn't get a government mandate because that would bring us to a national health insurance system. So when you think about it, there was nothing left, and that's why the individual mandate was so attractive to conservatives and to many Democrats as well.
Well, the shifting of the cost to consumers is also a design feature, right? The whole idea is to make people price conscious and to cut back on treatment.
And to shop around. It's what I like to call the shop around theory of healthcare. The theory doesn't really hold water because healthcare is just not like any other commodity like cars or computers, which might be fun to buy. Healthcare is not very much fun to buy for most people. They're just not in the same universe. But still, that notion became very popular as the 90s wore on. And I used to give lots of talks during that time period, and people would want me to talk about how we can make consumers smarter and better shoppers for healthcare. And after a while, I got to thinking that these were just basically substitutes for not having a real national health insurance program.
And it's very difficult to shop for these things, right? The plans that are presented in the exchanges are opaque to most people. You don't know what you're getting, what you're paying for. There's so many things you can't anticipate when you buy. It's very much unlike buying a piece of electronics or a car.
Well, you don't know what illnesses you're going to get in the coming year. I mean, how many people can predict that? Nobody, really. And you often hear people say, well, if you have an illness like diabetes or an ongoing condition like high blood pressure or something like that, you can probably predict what your medication needs are going to be and so on and so forth. But I think that basically most people, and we have an example in the story of a man, a very well-educated man with a degree, graduate degree in finance, who became ill after he had purchased a policy last December. And he said, I didn't have a crystal ball to know exactly what I needed. But even he had terrific problems trying to find out what he should buy before he got sick. And it was very, very difficult because consumers not only are asked to estimate their risk, which of course is impossible to do, but they have to juggle these very complicated elements of a policy. Do you want a policy that has more coinsurance and a cheaper premium? Is that better for you? Or do you want to pay a higher premium up front and smaller coinsurance later on? And then if you mix some copays in, which everybody's used to, those are going away. So people aren't even going to see those dollar amounts that they might say, oh, well, I can afford $40 to go to the doctor. But that's not the same as paying 40% of a bill, which might be considerably more than $40. So I think people have to weigh those trade-offs, and I don't think they can do that very well.
You point out that there seems to be a substantial drop-off in the number of people who renew their policies on the exchanges from the first year to the second.
Yeah, the first year's renewals really weren't too great overall, and in some states like California, they were not very good at all. In California, only about 65% of the people came back. They lost about a third. And this sort of suggests that either people had trouble paying the coinsurance and decided that this really wasn't insurance after all, and why bother, or they found the policy wasn't of use to them, or simply just had budget problems and insurance just was something that was expendable. It's also possible that some of the people who didn't return got other insurance off of the exchange, or a spouse got a job or something. But I think it's fair to say that many of them became dissatisfied with the products that they bought. And I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens in this next year when we see what the renewals are going to be next March, when we have new figures coming out, to see whether those people come back or not.
We do see some polls that suggest that people are somewhat happy with what they're getting. Is that because they haven't had to use it yet?
Most likely. And I think I want to point out one thing about polls, that in doing survey research using satisfaction scales and so forth, almost always two-thirds of the people are satisfied or very satisfied. It's just sort of, that's the way it is when you do those kind of polls. So I think we have to be careful about what kind of polls are used and what they really mean. And the other issue, of course, is that, of course, you're going to be happy if you haven't used the policy yet. And some people may have had good experiences, but if you haven't had a good experience, you're not going to be very happy with the plan.
I'm speaking with Trudy Lieberman, a contributing editor of the Columbia Journalism Review and author of the piece, Wrong Prescription, in the July issue of Harper's. So what about these plans? There's this array of mind-boggling complex plans, bronze, silver, gold. What are the characteristics of these things?
Well, there are four tiers of plans, and they're all characterized by the name of a medal. And the lowest tier is the bronze plan, which is the cheapest plan on the exchange usually, and comes with a great deal of cost sharing. It's only designed actuarially to cover 60% of someone's medical costs, which means that the consumer or patient pays 40%. Then we have the silver plans, which are the most popular plans because people who have incomes below 250% of the federal poverty level get help paying those cost-sharing amounts, the co-payments and the co-insurance. So, of course, if you're in that category, you would buy a silver plan. Those can be fairly pricey. Sometimes they may be cheaper than a bronze plan, depending on the company, the area you live, the state, and so forth, the insurance company. Those plans are designed to cover 70% of someone's costs, meaning that the patient consumer pays 30%, and then you get into the gold and platinum plans. There are really not that many platinum plans on the market because they're very expensive, but those are the ones that cover 90% of your medical expenses, and if you can afford them, they give you the most protection. The gold plans are basically similar to the old Blue Cross plans that most of us had all of our lives, where the plan paid 80% and you paid the other 20%, but in the times when we had those 80-20 Blue Cross plans, the other 20% wasn't very expensive, so nobody really felt that pinch very much. And those plans, too, are generally much more expensive than the silver and bronze plans, but not always. Sometimes there are variations of all of this.
10 or 20% of a not very complicated medical procedure can be an enormous amount of money.
It certainly can, depending on where you live. I mean, certainly in New York, certainly in California, Florida, many of the states that have very high-cost medical machines in their states can be very, very costly. And I think that there is data out from some of the foundations and other surveys that show that many people are reporting hardships in paying those amounts and are skipping care. And recall that that is exactly what the ACA was intended not to have happen. As I remember all the slogans leading up to this, it was, you're going to get the care that you're going to need and you're going to have a chance to get care and so on and so forth. And certainly some people have gotten that chance, but others have not.
And what about cost controls? Is anything going to be done to keep, people are saying we're not seeing very much inflation in medical care or health insurance premiums now. Is that going to continue, or is we're going to see skyrocketing costs in the coming years?
I think we don't know for sure. I think what we've seen so far is that the fact that the hospital rates have been held down by the ACA, and that's been a good thing, has helped to kind of suppress some of the healthcare inflation, and also the fact that we've just come through a very big recession and people have really not gone to the doctor a lot, and people do think that there's been some pullback in terms of people not using services. Whether that's a good thing for them or not, we really don't know. So we don't know long-term what's going to happen, and there's lots of noise that I'm seeing now where we're going to be beginning to see price rises on the provider side. And when that happens, we're going to see increased premiums. And I think we don't really know yet. It's going to take another year or so to know exactly what the rates are going to be on the insurance premiums going forward. And I think that that is largely due to the law has offered the insurers some carrots and some protections against what we call anti-selection. That's an insurance term that means a company gets so many sick people in the plan and the claims are just sort of overwhelming. And unless they price their products correctly, the insurance company can really be hurt. So they've had protections from that because of what was written into the law. But those protections go away in the next couple of years. And when that happens, we're not exactly sure what's going to happen to premiums. Some observers think that there are going to be very high premiums that are going to hit next summer during the middle of the presidential campaign. And we're beginning to see some premium rises in some states now in this next go-around. We're definitely seeing double-digit increases in some states on some plans. And that's the insurers trying to kind of level out things. But we've also seen another phenomenon that some of the insurers that came in with the very low rates that we saw the first year and that were written about by the media saying, see, Obamacare hasn't increased premiums, many of those companies had this anti-selection that I just explained and have now come in with much higher rates. So we're seeing a lot of shift going on among the carriers in terms of rates.
And one of the things that was supposed to keep costs down was competition. We're now seeing talk of large mergers in the industry, people talking about five giant insurers being whittled down to three over the next several years. What's that going to do?
Well, that's going to narrow the field, certainly. The insurers are folding themselves, the companies are folding themselves into each other, which was certainly expected. And anybody who sort of understands markets knows that this does happen. It happened in autos, it happened in steel, it happened in airlines, it happened in a lot of other U.S. markets. So we are going to see that happen. We don't know exactly yet which companies are going to be dominant. But it's going to be interesting to watch what happens because they will be so powerful and have so much of the claims data that's out there that they are really going to be able to price their products however they want them. And it will be very difficult for newcomers to come into those kind of markets. We're already seeing some areas, like New York City, for example, has a fair amount of competition. There are lots of companies offering lots of different kinds of plans. But upstate New York, we don't see very much competition at all. And the man I described earlier who had trouble selecting a policy because he couldn't guess his illness had three choices. And when he winnowed that down further, he basically had one or two choices when he looked at the plans that were offered. So he had virtually no choice at all. And I think we see spots all over the country where that's the case. And some states we see much more competition than others. So I think that it's a very local thing, and I think it's hard to say that competition has helped keep things down. You might argue in some states or some areas like New York perhaps, but not in other areas.
Well, the thing that other countries use to keep costs down is government pressure, whether it's a fully government system or a very heavily government-regulated system. That is essentially illegal under the ACA in many cases, isn't it?
Well, that's just not what the ACA was set up to do. Under the Prescription Drug Act that was passed in 2003 actually does make it illegal, I guess, for the government. The government can make something illegal. The government cannot negotiate prices with the drug companies to come up with a price for what it pays for drugs under the Medicare drug benefit. But the ACA was not set up to give the government authority to push back against the power of providers, which is what all the other countries do, and that's one reason why they have much lower costs and end up covering everybody. And so we didn't do that because that would never fly. That was never on the table. So we ended up with cost control measures that in themselves might be good, like health IT, for example, or some more coordinated care. But as far as really lowering the tab, I you know, I'm not sure that's going to happen, and I don't think a lot of other people think that's going to happen. And we haven't seen the effect of any of that really yet.
Finally, Massachusetts is something of a laboratory for the national effects of the ACA. Obamacare bears a lot of relation to Romney Care. How are things working out there?
The exchange in Massachusetts has not worked very well. They were first. They had this shopping exchange called the Connector that seemed to be working reasonably well before 2013. And after 2013, for a whole variety of reasons, never really fully investigated by the media up there, the exchange has not worked very well. There have been problems with people with verifying eligibility, with getting payments, with making selections. There's just been a lot of problems, and I understand they are continuing. But the biggest problem of all is that the state really hasn't controlled the costs very well. And, you know, the people up there argue, well, this law was really never meant to do that. We're going to start working on it, and we're trying to make some changes that would make that happen. But that said, Massachusetts still has the highest costs in the country, and some people would even say in the world. And the healthcare costs also consume, I guess, about half of the state budget in Massachusetts, and I don't know how sustainable that is long term. The state has also been at the forefront of some of this shop-around stuff, and there is some price posting going on, and I know that WBUR in Boston has looked into this fairly extensively and done some really good work up there, and it's not clear whether any of those efforts are really going to make a dent in the healthcare situation in Massachusetts. And the real problem is that the small employers have been complaining about this law for years now because they have pretty much borne the brunt of the cost increases that have gone on. And they've had double-digit increases for small employer plans since 2006, for most of the years from 2006 onward. And that's because of the way they just changed the risk pool and everything up there. So I would say the verdict up there is probably quite mixed. Most people in the state have coverage, but most people in the state had it to begin with. So we can't look at Massachusetts as really the example of how well the ACA is working in terms of coverage. It would be more instructive, I think, to look at a state like Mississippi or Tennessee and see how coverage is faring down there. And we know that there are many problems in Mississippi, and from my own reporting, we know that there are still many, many thousands of people uninsured in Tennessee.
As Trudy Lieberman, author of an article on Obamacare in the July issue of Harper's. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program Behind the News. Back after some music. Some of Doctor Doctor by The Who from EGADS almost 50 years ago. Next up, Leah Gordon, historian who teaches at the Stanford University School of Education. Her book, From Power to Prejudice, The Rise of Racial Individualism in Mid-Century America, is just out from the University of Chicago Press. It charts how the broad concerns among the scholars who studied race and race relations in the early decades of the 20th century moved from a focus on power and social structures to a narrower one on individual psychology and attitudes. As she said in an email to me, Americans have a long history of describing racial injustice in terms of individual perpetrators and victims, that is, of describing the complex problem of racial inequality and oppression too narrowly in terms of prejudice and violated rights. This matters, she continues, because overly simplistic notions of racial injustice have led to insufficient reformist approaches, often those that ask too much of our schools, made residential segregation and school segregation difficult to fight, left much racialized economic inequality untouched, and opened the door for conservative attacks and affirmative action through the logic of colorblindness. Leah Gordon. Let's start by talking about some of just the general taxonomy of theoretical approaches to racial relations that you read about, what you call systemic, relational, and individual or psychological. What do these each represent?
In the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, I saw four primary ways of understanding what the so-called race problem, this was the term used in the mid-century decades, that sort of conflated racism, racial prejudice, racial injustice, racial inequality, without neatly delineating between those. Much in the way, interestingly, I think we use the term racism today as a catch-all phrase. And so advocates of racial justice in the mid-20th century decades understood the race problem, I think, in four primary ways. One was some saw it as a psychological problem rooted in attitudes best solved by anti-prejudice education, though folks like Gordon Allport, who advocated this approach, also thought that legal desegregation was essential. Others, the NAACP is the most familiar and best example, described the race issue largely in legal terms as the violation of African American rights as individuals. In this view, the sources of the race problem were discriminatory laws, and the first step forward was legal desegregation and anti-discrimination legislation. And it's those two, the psychological and the rights-based or legal conceptions, that I think of in terms of racial individualism. And yet in the 20s, 30s, and first half of the 1940s, and in some ways continuing throughout the later period, there were also systemic and relational approaches. So those who took a systemic approach in which what happens to the individual is determined by changes in the larger social structure or system, and I took that systemic relational dispositional categorization from Charles Tilly. Many sociologists and anthropologists in the 20s and 30s focused on racial conflict and inequality and suggested that these large-scale social processes, systems, or structures caused the patterns of racial inequality they saw. And so the best example of a systemic approach is scholars associated with Robert Park's Chicago School of Social Ecology, who described a race relations cycle in which racial conflict resulted from large-scale, often inevitable patterns of technological change, global trade, and migrations that produced recurring cycles of intergroup contact, competition, accommodation, and assimilation. So there was many variety between sociologists, anthropologists, in these kinds of theories, but the point that I think is important with the systemic is that evolving social structures were the agents of change in this view, and individuals could do little to intervene. And some these views are often criticized as naturalizing racial inequality, suggesting, well, it's an inevitable process. Policymakers just have to wait it out.
Now, is this produced by, say, a competition for in the labor market or for housing? Or
Yeah, that's how. So this systemic, the Robert Parks view is that, well, there's these migratory patterns are the agent of change, and when migrations happen, there's this inevitable pattern of competition that results, and it eventually works itself out. And he's criticized because he sees the end of that as assimilation, and because he also suggests that this is sort of natural and inevitable. The final approach that I think is really important, because it's the one that is so hard for us to think about today, is what I call the political economic approach. And I associate it with Tilly's conception of relational because, in contrast to the systemic, where individuals are part of a larger social system, a relational theory suggests that there are different groups that are in relation to one another. So the systemic and the political economic kind of bleed into each other, but advocates of a political economic vision of the race issue put power relations, oppression, and exploitation by some over others at the center of their theories, and this is what I think is important. So this approach was especially popular among interracial groups of leftist civil rights activists during the Depression into the early 1940s. And the implications of the political economic approach, which essentially said racism is a rationalization, ideas about race are rationalizations for patterns that are at root political and economic. They're rooted in slavery, labor exploitation, and the politics of white supremacy that justified it. The implications of that approach
in the 1940s and especially in the McCarthyist 1950s were quite radical. Either you say this is rooted in liberal capitalism and we need to do something about liberal capitalism to rectify the problem, or they suggest that far-reaching social welfare programs and regulation of labor markets, etc., are what is needed. So even though many who were not Marxists rooted the race issue in political economy, they often had a hard time thinking about what the implications of those theories were for practice in ways that seemed realistic in the post-war political climate.
But are the people who focus on psychology, were they interested in the social origins of these attitudes, or were they just sort of spring spontaneously out of human nature?
Well, it depends. So some of them thought they sprang out of human nature. Others, Alport's a good example, thought that all a social scientist could know was what happened through the individual, right? So Alport had this sort of interesting view of the race issue as being multifaceted. He cited Oliver Cromwell Cox, who was sort of the economic determinist, and he describes needing to explain the race issue in competing ways as he talks about many different keys on a ring. And yet when pushed, Alport says things like, it is only through individual minds that we can understand the operation of large-scale social forces. So I think his disciplinary blinders or his disciplinary predispositions led him to believe that there were only some ways that you could understand how prejudice was generated and reproduced.
And you write about the interwar interracial left. These were my sympathies lies personally, so I'd be curious about who these people are and what institutional affiliations they had.
Tom Segrew does a lot on this in Sweet Land of Liberty, and Nikhil Singh in Black as a Country talks a lot about this group. People associated with the National Negro Congress, the Amenia Conference, it's a whole host of black and white leftists who are saying that race and class are intimately intertwined. And what I think is interesting is that the historiography has tended to talk about this interracial left as a 30s radical moment, although the radicalism sort of moved out from people like Du Bois or Ralph Bunche in those years who had explicit communist sympathies. The logics behind a lot of those communist sympathies were shared by many political moderates. So even in the mid-1940s, and even some ways into the early 1950s, people at the Fisk Race Relations Institutes, which is the subject of one of my chapters, start by explaining the sources of the race problem in profoundly historical and political economic terms. So they argue, people like this woman, Ina Corian Brown, who is an anthropologist, or Charles Johnson, who becomes the first African-American president of Fisk and is a sociologist, work from the contention that racial injustice and even the race idea itself emerges to rationalize labor exploitation, white supremacy, and the political oppression of slavery and Jim Crow. What some of them are less clear on is how it's continuing to function as an ideology rationalizing inequality outside of the context of slavery or the plantation systems. And so I think there's some implications in their ideas for the way race as an ideology is continuing to function in the present, but they often talk about it happening historically.
I'm Sukhavalea Gordon, who is a historian who teaches at the Stanford School of Education and is the author of From Power to Prejudice, The Rise of Racial Individualism in Mid-Century America, published by University of Chicago Press. I want to bring up Myrtle's book, An American Dilemma. Its influence seems somewhat different from its content.
Yes, and that is my contention. So Myrtle, I think, is a great example of how research is framed really matters. So the book's huge. It's like 1,000 pages. The majority of the evidence he compiles is about the politics and economics of Southern white supremacy and, to some extent, labor discrimination and political exclusion in the urban North. He's a social democrat from Sweden. He's an economist. The bulk of his research and most of his reformist recommendations are about political economy. And yet, during World War II, he goes back to Sweden. The book Gunnar Myrdal and America's Conscience does a great job talking about sort of the context in which he makes his decisions about what to argue. But he decides to frame this volume in terms of the American conscience and morality. And so the soundbite that everyone remembers from the volume is that the American Negro problem is a problem in the heart of the American. It's there the interracial tension has its focus. It's there the decisive struggle goes on. That's a quote from the beginning of An American Dilemma. And so it's not entirely clear why he decides to frame this huge synthesis of research that is largely political and economic in nature in terms of white morality and the white conscience. But that is what gets remembered, and that is what both critics and supporters take away from it in many ways. Although there are certainly critics out there, people like Oliver Cromwell Cox or Herbert Apfiger, who point out this discrepancy, right, and say, you had a lot of great evidence, but why did you frame it in these ridiculous terms? And in fact, one of my favorite quotes from this sort of controversy between Myrdal and Marxist sociologist Oliver Cromwell Cox is that what Myrdal is doing in the way he frames the race issue is mysticism. So Cox argues that the race issue is really produced by the calculated economic interest of the Southern oligarchy. He suggests that Myrdal's theory is mysticism because, and I'm quoting him, beliefs are assumed to be prime movers in Myrdal's theory. They keep the Negroes low. This is mysticism. If beliefs per se could subjugate a people, the beliefs which Negroes hold about whites should be as effective as those which whites hold about Negroes. That's the end of the quote. So he gets called out on this ideological turn, but trying to figure out why Myrdal makes the choice is quite difficult.
This also reminds me of the pollster Frank Luntz's dictum that it's not what you say, it's what they hear.
Right, right, right. One of the things I suggest is that the political climate in which Myrdal writes and the political climate in which his book is received, which is right on, you know, it's the moment of 1945 when World War II ends and the emerging McCarthyist era, are very different, in that the fact that it sort of gets received in this rightward moving post-war political moment helps to shape the kind of research that follows it and what people hear from what he said. But he's not to blame. I mean, he chose to frame, you know, the introduction and conclusion frame the problem in terms of the white psyche.
You also write a lot about how the Rockefeller Foundation and other elite of philanthropies shape the research agenda, which is also partly determine what people heard. What was their influence? What did they push towards?
Yeah. So I title my chapter on the Rockefeller Foundation, Data and Not Trouble. And I take that quote from a labor activist, this guy Benjamin Stolberg, who in 1930 criticizes a Rockefeller-funded large research volume that Charles Johnson, who was then working for the Urban League and was sort of on loan from the Urban League to the Rockefeller Foundation for this interracial committee it had put together, again, in response to racial violence, this time the 1919 Chicago race riot. So Charles Johnson had sort of written the Negro and American Civilization with Rockefeller support and compiled this enormous amount of research on racial disparity in health and education and employment and housing, and sort of presented this to the Rockefeller Foundation. Without much attention, Stolberg argues to the sources that are, the factors that are creating this disparity. And so when Stolberg is trying to reason why Johnson would choose to present all this evidence of racial injustice and oppression without naming racial injustice and oppression, Stolberg argues, well, Johnson, who had was then and for much of his life a favorite of the foundation's, understood that, as Stolberg puts it, the secretariat of this noblesse oblige wants data and not trouble. And so I think that the attempt to delineate social science and racial politics, which is something that the Rockefeller Foundation is working to do throughout its history, to delineate social science on race, social reform on race, both of which they want to support and be involved in, and racial politics, from which they really want to remain aloof. That pattern is an important part of understanding why some ways of approaching racial injustice are celebrated and others really don't have much influence. And in particular, by the early 1950s, there are a number of dynamics at work which ensure that the Rockefeller Foundation, which in some ways is one of the only leading foundations sort of willing to support any research on race at all, it does it in a way that is very objective, is very much tied to scientism, and only addresses, as far as I could tell, only addresses racial research under the rubric of human relations. And so in 1953, the foundation hosts this conference on research and human relations that, in contrast to some of the 1920s conferences, which had included members of the interracial left, various kinds of activists, and were deliberately interracial in makeup, the early 1950s conference on research and human relations, because it's focusing on an academic field, is only the cream of the crop of sociologists, anthropologists, and psychologists from the most elite white research institutions. And they actually joke about how they know each other so well because they're always at the same agenda-setting conferences. And so the way this conference, which deals largely with the new field of the behavioral sciences, or this, which human relations is in some ways a euphemism or the same kind of term for this new field of the interdisciplinary behavioral sciences that the Ford Foundation had just launched an initiative in. This is the era when Stanford Center for the Advanced Study of the Behavioral Sciences had emerged. The behavioral sciences were sort of the new hot thing. Because the foundation decides to include a discussion of race and culture conflict, which is one of the papers that sociologist Robin Williams presents at this conference, through the lens of the behavioral sciences, they do it in a way that is, people like Williams suggest, atomistic. So they either don't touch the race issue at all, or they treat it through this individualistic, largely psychological lens that I suggest winds up having a lot of power in shaping the terms of debate in race, relations, social science throughout much of the post-war period. And I think the reasons the Rockefeller Foundation does this are the intersection of not only McCarthyism, so in the post-World War II period, Rockefeller Foundations and many other foundations are the subject of congressional investigations into their supposed subversive or anti-American activity. And in fact, they all point to Myrdal's An American Dilemma, which the Carnegie Corporation had supported. The McCarthyists point to An American Dilemma as the emblem of leftist foundation-supported social science, right? McCarthyism is one of the reasons why there's this turn to individualizing race if you're going to touch the race issue at all. It's also the era of ascendant scientism, and the National Sciences Foundation had been established in the mid-1940s, and social scientists, many of whom are at this conference on human relations, were very concerned that they were going to be left out of the NSF grant money because the social sciences weren't considered objective enough. And again, Myrdal's An American Dilemma is trotted out as the example of how social science is actually just political, it's not objective. And so the pressures of behavioralism, anti-radicalism, and scientism sort of coincide in the 1950s at places like the Rockefeller Foundation to either lead the foundation to not touch the race issue at all, or when they do, to treat it in ways that are quantitative, that are individualistic, and that have the air of objectivity and can't be deemed somehow politically tainted.
Insofar as any prescription flows from this kind of research, it is education, right?
Yeah, and so that was sort of my original interest in this approach I've termed racial individualism, which is essentially a term I describe to look at theories of the race problem that presented prejudiced attitudes and discriminatory actions as the root of racial conflict, that make individuals the units of analysis in the study of race relations, and that suggest that one could secure racial justice by changing the minds of discriminating white individuals through education, and protecting the rights of African Americans in the face of unreformed bigots and their unjust laws. But much of the logic that follows from defining racism as prejudice is that the solution is, well, let's just educate Americans out of their prejudices. Now, there's all sorts of complications related to efforts to link social science and social reform that complicate that neat binary. So even the psychologists, people like Alport and Adorno, recognize that extremely bigoted individuals can't be educated out of their prejudices. And yet during World War II, there is this flowering of organizations committed to anti-prejudice education. And in some ways, it's funny, many of the social scientists I look at were very committed to linking social science and social action, and they often wanted to have, you know, they had sort of a paternalistic vision of social scientists figuring out the truth and then telling activists what to do. And yet, as you look at the institutions, the academic institutions, places like the University of Chicago's Race Relations Committee, to some extent the Rockefeller Foundation, even in some ways, though, to a lesser extent, places like the Journal of Negro Education or Fisk's Race Relations Institutes, the relationship between social science and social action winds up being a lot more complicated, because at places like the University of Chicago, it's the fact that there are all these anti-prejudice activists on the ground interested in prejudice and interested in the racial violence and conflict it might cause that actually winds up shaping much of the research that gets produced. So there's a combination of they have social survey methods, they have methods that are much better at measuring individual attitudes than large-scale social structures or political economic systems, right? And so this is, World War II is also the era of the rise of the quantitative social survey. And so there's this coalescing of having the methods and having all this enthusiasm for a particular kind of reformist solution that winds up shaping the direction much of the science takes, even though the scholar activists were hoping that social science would set reformist agendas, not follow them.
We're just about out of time, but I'm curious, your research stops mostly in the 1960s, but what did your research suggest for a way we could think about race today? It seems like individualist attitudes are very prominent. We've got, you know, Tim Wise at his anti-racist workshops. We've got people talking about the minds of individual cops in cases of violence. What do you, as a result of what you've been talking about and researching, what do you say?
Yeah, so I've thought about this a lot. And on the one hand, and I've been thinking about this a little bit in terms of the Dolezal situation also, so I think that situation is very interesting because it's exposing race as a social construction. So on the one hand, as an intellectual historian, I'm excited about this moment of unmasking racial essentialism. We've been saying race is a social construction for a long time. She's actually living as it is. That's quite interesting. On the other hand, I think we need to not forget that race is a particular kind of social construction. Barbara Fields' notion of racist ideology is especially important along these lines, and that it's a fiction that serves particular functions, that does particular political work in specific historical moments. So race may be a fiction, but racism, racial oppression, and racial inequality are very real. And so I have two thoughts about what this means for the contemporary moment now and how we should understand race and racism. So we need historically attentive notions of race, and we need to pay attention to the profound danger of the conservative rhetoric of colorblindness today. So if race is an ideology, so is our contemporary language of colorblindness. And by this I mean the conservative reading of the Constitution as colorblind in ways that legitimize retreats from affirmative action and retreats from desegregation. So what colorblindness today, I think, shares with racial individualism is that it is history and power evasive or history and power blind, and it fails to acknowledge how histories of racial inequality and injustice create privilege and disprivilege in the present. So I think one way we need to understand racism and racial injustice is profoundly historical. If a family could not get a home loan, could not buy a house in the 1940s because of restrictive covenants, and discrimination in housing markets, their children today don't have the same kind of down payment for their own house. Those patterns, I think, are crucial. And then the second way I think we need to understand racial injustice and oppression that I think is coming out of the recent uprisings in Ferguson and Baltimore is in ways that are closely tied to class and economic inequality. So on the one hand, the specter of police brutality that we're seeing points to the enduring power of prejudice. Dangerous power of prejudice and bigotry, whether unconscious or conscious, is nowhere more evident than in all these horrific incidents of police brutality. At the same time, what I think the current activists responding to this are pointing to is the systemic nature of racial discrimination. It's not just exceptional individuals, but systems and institutional patterns that produce the profound inequality and patterns of arrest and brutality we're seeing. And then I also think these movements are in important ways making clear that we can't talk about urban racial injustice without talking about racial inequality and poverty. So activists, we're essentially arguing that if we want to fight for racial justice. We need to fight police brutality, but we also need to fight the profound underfunding of schools, the troubling school-to-prison pipelines, the crisis of mass incarceration, the economic marginalization of many inner-city and increasingly poor suburban communities, patterns of unemployment in communities where these incidents occurred, the absence of a living wage, the tattered social safety net that's supposed to help those capitalist groups has left behind. So these objectives are in no way new. One of my favorite quotes from Martin Luther King Jr. is that while desegregating public accommodations and securing the vote did not cost the nation anything, he told students at Howard that, quote, grappling with basic class issues between the privileged and the underprivileged will cost the nation something to solve. And I think in an era when democratic politics has moved in troubling ways towards the center, when redistributive policies are so often seem off the table, we need to make sure that calls for racial justice remain tied to calls for economic justice, and that economic justice is defined in more substantive terms than simply equal opportunity.
As Leah Gordon, a historian who teaches at Stanford's School of Education. Her book, From Power to Prejudice, is just out from the University of Chicago Press. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some more melodramatic Mahler. This from the last movement of his third symphony, performed by the Vienna Philharmonic under Pierre Boulez. Till next week, bye.